You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who were at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 45 is, can ethics be founded on human moral sentiments? As opposed to alien moral sentiments, I don't know. And we read selections from David Hume's Treatise on Human Nature from 1740, and Adam Smith's The Theory of Moral Sentiments from 1759. Our selections from these came from the anthology British Moralists, 1650 to 1800, Volume 2, compiled by D.D. Raphael. If you look on partiallyexaminedlife.com, we'll spell out exactly which selections we read and link to online versions of the original texts. My name is Mark Linsenmeyer, positively evaluating my own approval of my actions in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, experiencing both gratitude and resentment in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allwyn in Boston, Massachusetts.
This is Getty Lustala, performing the awful virtue of self-command in Atlanta, Georgia.
Awful. Before we meet Getty, thank you to Bernhard Bürgen for a donation this week. Hey, folks that are donating to Partially Examined Life, over the next couple months, we'll get free MP3s of the latest album by my band, New People. Or I can refrain from sending that to you, if that would be a more valuable service than providing it to you. All right, Getty, who are you? Why are you here?
I'm a graduate student in philosophy at Georgia State University. My main area of interest is in modern philosophy, and I'm writing my thesis currently on Hume and his conception of freedom.
Welcome, Getty.
Thanks.
Yeah, welcome.
Yeah, so I don't know. I never had to read Adam Smith, certainly not his ethical works in graduate school or anywhere else. So stumbling across somebody who'd actually studied that recently was a find.
Yeah, I took a seminar on it last fall, actually. One of the professors here, Eric Wilson, taught a class on Kant and Smith. It was really interesting, and it wasn't a book that I had expected on really getting that much out of, but it's actually quite a joy to read.
And the other impetus to doing this, besides our march forward, we wanted to get to Karl Marx and to The Wealth of Nations and some other more modern political stuff, but was on our recent Patricia Churchland episode. She had referred to Hume quite a bit, such that we actually officially read some Hume for that episode, but that was really just a taste and made me want to do some more. So Hume and Smith give us some early alternatives for something like a naturalist ethics, right? An ethics that is in line, is compatible with modern science, if you want to say.
Just to kind of narrow that down, most philosophers who hear the phrase moral naturalism will think of, it's a brand of moral realism that says moral judgments have truth values, they correspond to objective moral facts, and that those facts are based in natural facts, whether they're identical or reducible. So I think Hume's project, while it's naturalist in a broader sense, that he thinks of himself as examining human nature, let's say, it's not necessarily in line with the project of moral naturalism, because Hume, right, his whole derivation of moral sentiment is compatible with being what's called a non-cognitivist, or compatible with thinking that moral judgments don't have truth values and that they don't really express anything but emotions, which, if you believe that, then there's nothing to naturalize. Naturalizing is trying to save a form of moral realism, and it's unclear whether Hume is even a moral realist.
Right. And though Smith is usually put in the same category with him, they were friends. They had the same influencers. Francis Hutcheson is a guy that was maybe invented this moral sentimentalism kind of stuff, or at least was the popularizer right before him, who was actually Smith's teacher and read the draft of the third book of the treatise by Hume that was on morals. Although apparently Hutcheson didn't like it. So I don't know.
No, he didn't.
In any case, there's a commonality there, but actually reading Smith, he seems to maybe have a more straightforward view of that. Yes, morality is real and we know about it, but still he's in common with Hume that we kind of know about it by reflecting on our sentiments about things, right?
Yeah.
As opposed to the rationalists, which we talked about Kant in another episode. Kant is later than Hume, of course, later than both these guys. But the idea that we figure out morality straight from reason somehow, both of these guys are instead saying, let's look at your feelings. And that has to somehow, maybe in a very circuitous way, but provide the foundations for morality.
You could interpret Hume as a sort of non-cognitivist, but I think that would be not to be in line with his project, because I think to even submit him to that kind of framework of cognitivism and non-cognitivism assumes that there's something else to morality except the sentiments. I think he's pretty clear in, I think you guys, for the Churchland episode, you read some of the Second Inquiry, and he's pretty clear in the introduction about the sort of realness of morality in terms of the way that it shapes our lives through the sentiment. So I think that that's not really even a question for Hume, whether it exists or not.
Hume wouldn't phrase it in those terms, but the secondary literature is filled with arguments on whether or not to interpret Hume as a cognitivist or non-cognitivist or how to interpret it. And I think the important thing here is that you could take a Humean position on moral sentiments and you could go either way. You could say, yes, there are such things that moral judgments do have truth values, or you could say that, no, they don't. And then if you do accept the idea that they have truth values, then you could conceivably be a non-naturalist Humean and say that those must be based in non-natural properties, or you could be a naturalist Humean. And I think, Getty, would you agree in the sense that Hume's position here is compatible with a whole range of meta-ethical positions?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Yeah, definitely.
And here's where Seth jumps in and tells us we're getting hit.
It's like, wow, you guys are really jumping the gun. So how about we lay a little groundwork before you start talking about how Hume can or can't be interpreted in meta-ethical systems?
Well, the point is, if we're going to start calling Hume a moral naturalist, then we need to say what that is.
Well, we didn't. Mark did.
Because that's a contemporary sort of thing.
Something that is not overtly anti-science. How about that?
Yeah.
Well, I think framing it in terms of his opposition to the rationalism that came before is probably the...
If we're looking at the contemporary moral landscape, and I'm not talking about among philosophers, I'm talking about among our listening population, probably there's still the, you can only have morality if you have God telling you what to do, and then you have everybody else who is... No, maybe we don't need that. In fact, if you read Plato's Euthyphro, you could even think that it's incoherent that God's commands would themselves dictate right or wrong, that instead he's commanding in accordance with right or wrong, right? This is a very old position. But you might say we don't need necessarily to refer to religion to figure out what is right and wrong. Okay, then what else could it be founded on? It's founded on something in human experience. The question then becomes, how do we figure out, you know, is it because we all have this innate faculty of reason that in the same way we could figure out basic mathematical truths, we could just look and see what moral goodness is? That's the rationalist position. Or is it some things just really piss me off and they piss you off too? And when we sit back and reflect on our being pissed off, you know, we can see patterns in how we're pissed off. And somehow out of that, we build morality. Both of the latter two options there, I think, are compatible with science, putting aside the term moral naturalism.
Yeah, I mean, I think the compatible with science part, you're getting at the idea that you can, say, look at the structure of the mind. What Hume was doing, even though he's sort of introspecting, he's thinking of it as an empirical project, right?
Mm-hmm, definitely.
The idea is that whether you're introspecting and looking at the structure of the mind or whether you're looking at brain structure, is that you can found moral behavior in human nature in some way, mm-hmm, or human physiology. But that project... Today, that's sort of uncontroversial across any ethical system. The idea that you can say, well, yes, there's a certain human nature, there are certain faculties that we possess that ground our ability to make moral judgments, that's sort of an uncontroversial thing that's taken for granted across any ethical system.
So the other purpose of this, though, then, is since we're following up on the Churchland episode, is since Wes and Seth were not on there, now they get to say the things they would have liked to have said there and be as nasty as they want in a very oblique way as Wes was just doing.
No, I mean, touching upon that, it's just, you know, we've been talking a lot on the blog about the odd-is distinction and Sanharis and all that stuff. I think some people are confused. They think that establishing facts about human nature and saying that we can derive moral behavior from those facts gets at bridging the odd-is distinction. That has nothing to do with the odd-is distinction unless you get into a far more sophisticated constructivist, neopragmatist, or neo-Kantian position. The facts at issue are the moral judgments themselves. The question is whether or not you can get from descriptive empirical facts to moral facts via deduction or possibly via induction.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where I thought I saw some confusion in Churchland. She was kind of vague enough that it was hard to tell.
I think you're right, Wes. I think what the problem is with the Churchland, for example, is that the only way that you can point at human nature and the sort of structure of what Butler would call the inner frame of the person and draw sort of normative conclusions from that is if you have built into how the human being was structured some conception of God. So that's the only way to really bridge that, by looking at how humans actually are. So I think that's right.
Hey, Mark.
Yes?
It occurs to me that we haven't laid the ground rules.
That is exactly what I was going to suggest, because he mentioned Bishop Butler there, which clearly was a dropping of something. So here's your quiz, Getty. I think you should know we quiz the guests. Can you name any of our discussion ground rules?
Well, the one should be no name dropping.
Good job. Right. Just make your point. Don't say you would understand me if only you had read Schleiermacher and the Art of Pistol Whipping. I've had that one on my page here for about 4 months. I have not done one of those jokes in a little while. Any others that you can recall?
There's one about being accurate unless not doing so will be more fun, or something like that.
Sure. And the other one is, it's more general than the name dropping, but it's the same principle.
Try to assume that our audience doesn't know anything about any of this.
3 for 3, man.
I think maybe we should change the name dropping to arguments from authority, because the idea isn't that you can't bring up anyone else. And then, you know, often, Mark, you're reading more of the text than we are, so you're bringing things into it. It's not that you can't bring things into it that others haven't read. You just have to be willing to explain it. And
we were having an email dispute about that, so Seth was saying I should probably not do that, right?
I was just saying that I was not going to read all the stuff that you said you were going to read in addition. It's hard enough for me to keep up. This was a lot of reading for an episode.
Yeah, it really was.
Going for like the secondary sources and all that stuff was just too much for me.
Let me just say where this particular conflict over this one is coming from. So yes, of course, we could just say, let's try to do what we normally do with a text and read, you know, this chunk of Hume's treatise, or Hume's later Inquiry on Morals, you know, where he sort of restates the things in the treatise, or the Smith, or try to cram both texts in there like we normally do. They're both very long, right? Both the Hume and the Smith, especially the Smith, Theory of Moral Sentiments in original form. It's a hugely long book. To try to pick a selection from it, I mean, first, yes, I got Getty involved to try to just make him do that. But then his suggestion actually, it struck a chord for me. So this British Moralists book, which is actually 2 volumes by D.D. Raphael here, British Moral 1650 to 1800. Mm-hmm. I mean, the 2 volumes is really just 1 volume divided into 2 books because it would be too massive. But I own this from a course that I took in grad school called, I think, Moral Intuitionism or something. And what I really found cool about this, not only that it, so it has your big names, it has your Hobbes and your Hume, and it ends with Bentham. So in fact, a lot of these guys are prefiguring utilitarianism, if you want to go back and listen to that episode by us. And it's a dialogue. So it's giving short selections, not only from these big guys, but also from guys like Bishop Butler that you mentioned, or John Ballguy is a guy that I wouldn't mind bringing up, or many others that are sort of just giving you, it's not like Hume is just this genius talking out of nowhere. All these ideas that he was throwing around were floating around, like the determinism and things that's in him, and the way he talks about ideas leading to other ideas and motivation is all from Hobbes. And just to talk about moral sentiments in the first place, right, was Hutcheson, or there's another guy, the Earl of Shaftesbury. Mm-hmm. He's actually known by Shaftesbury instead of his actual name. But anyway, that course was kind of fun for me, is reading some of these selections by lesser known guys as well as more known guys, to just get at what are the arguments back and forth. Don't get lost in Hume himself, because as soon as you descend into Hume, if you really want to get at evaluating his particular views, you have to understand his epistemology. You have to understand his overall philosophy. It's just difficult. If we want to get sort of what is the modern upshot of this, let's try to state in 1 or 2 sentences it's based on moral sentiments. Well, what does that exactly mean? And then looking at what a couple different people have to say about this and what other people had to say against that, that was interesting to me. So that even though I did toward the end of this just immerse myself and like read as much of the Smith as I could read, even beyond the selections that were in here, my initial approach was this, was I want to skim these British moralist books, read a little bit from a lot of the authors again to get a flavor of what was going on at the time and where these ideas came from and why we should care about them now. Mm-hmm. But I will not try to convey the bulk of what I took in that through here. However, I did write down some questions that we can bring up in evaluating these guys from the rationalist John Ballguy, who is very near to Hume and Smith chronologically.
Sure.
All right. So, Seth, give the other side. You did the more immersive thing, right? What was your overall impression of these guys? Had you read any of them, Smith in particular, before?
In fact, I think I've been the one who's been advocating to read Smith. Hume I've read before, although it's been a long time. In fact, I was thinking back. Do you remember there are those canonical versions of the Hume? One was green and one was kind of like a red or burgundy.
Yeah, the burgundy, yeah.
The thick little paperbacks. I'm the one who listens to econ talk and has been getting all excited about reading Smith and getting into The Economist and kind of getting into that direction. Originally, I was the one who advocated to do Wealth of Nations. And then I said, oh, well, you know, we need to get into Theory of Moral Sentiments. I got to say, I had to slog through it a little bit. Now, maybe that's just a function of me trying to read on the Kindle. This is the first massive work that I've tried to read on the Kindle, which was not easy. Mark, you know, thinking about the difference between being normative and descriptive, and I kept coming back as I was reading this to, is he cataloging something or is this really a theory of moral sentiments? While I appreciated it, I'm anxious to see the outcome of this discussion because I'm hoping to gain a little bit more insight than I have. Hume, as always, is an absolute delight. And I think the older I get and the more I read, the more I become a Humean.
Yeah. Other folks' impressions. Obviously, Getty, you're excited about this. You're writing about it. How does this overall moral sentiment theory affect? Do you think this is still right on? It's not just of historical interest. This is super relevant now? Or
in some sense, I work more on his stuff on freedom, so I'm less tied to the debates in his moral philosophy. But I do find him and Smith's brand of sentimentalism, at least at the face, convincing. And I think Smith, personally, I find him a joy to read. I think some of the passages are just absolutely beautiful. I think as far as the best candidates for a theory of moral philosophy, they're definitely there.
Yeah, I agree.
Because they're reflecting our experiences and reporting so much on this is what we disapprove of, this is what we approve of, as opposed to a top-down theory, you know, it makes them seem much more initially plausible than, say, Kant, who you try to apply his abstract theory to actual cases, and it's really difficult, or utilitarianism, where it's just really maximizing the benefit for the greatest possible people is always going to be the best action. So if I need to kill you to make 1,000 people a little happy, that's okay. You know, just things jump out, these obvious exceptions to these rules. But if you don't start with rules and you're just cataloging, then there's less to initially attack. Unless you just think, and I got this impression that a lot of what Smith is saying is a result of his own, well, it's Scottish, but basically the English stoic sensibility, sense of propriety, etc.
I think that's right. There's definitely some passages where that comes through. I know there's one particular one when he's talking about utility and how that plays out as beauty in everyday life. And he gives the example of his butler putting things in the wrong places. And how that's just irritating. I remember when we read that in class, it was like, oh, it's kind of a little hard to identify with that these days.
But just the whole thing about what is proper is not to express too much emotion more than observers would be able to sympathize with you.
Well, that's the thing. It's all a function of what the independent observer would consider to be the appropriate amount of emotion to show, right?
Should we back up and say what this theory of moral sentiments is?
Please do.
Wes, do you want to do the introduction to the theory of moral sentiments?
Why don't you do that if you have...
Yes, slave, butler,
guest. Do you want me to say some stuff about Smith too, or just...
Maybe let's start with Hume, because...
Oh, start with Hume. Okay.
With Hume, we can get more at the meta-ethical issues. Smith is more rich as to the actual content.
I think that like Smith is going to elaborate on the whole, what the moral sentiment is, and have a more sophisticated theory of that. But as far as getting at what is Hume responding to in the rationalists and what is his argument about why rationalism doesn't work and so on and so forth.
Okay. One of the main people that Hume is responding to in all of his texts is a philosopher named Samuel Clarke, who is an English theologian who is kind of seen as the sort of the height of like moral rationalism. So he thought that performing moral actions was just like doing math equations, and there's a lot of talk of fittedness in Clarke. So it's the idea that these moral truths are sort of written into the universe in some way, and that what you have to do is sort of get at how everything is connected. It's a sort of conceptual way of looking at morality.
It's always the same example, right? It's gratitude and beneficence, that those concepts just fit together. If somebody does something nice for you, it just fits with that to do something nice back.
Yeah, and the example of mathematics is used all the time. So like you can see in Hume, even though he doesn't reference Clarke, he'll talk about fitting or fittedness when he's talking about rationalism. So he's going after Clarke in those examples. Do we want to talk about the specific arguments that Hume gives?
Yeah, I mean, just that you can sort of see out of his epistemology why this would not be okay with him, because seeing this fittedness, or really any other truth that you would get at through reason, right, through what you would do to figure out math problems, is not going to be something that, according to Hume, could be a motivator, mm-hmm. right? Because yeah. everything you experience for Hume is either an impression or an mm-hmm. idea.
Where an idea is like a copy of an impression.
Yeah, it's like a fainter yeah. version.
Yeah.
And ideas are what reason deals with. Mm-hmm. That's the manipulation. But it doesn't deal with sort of the raw stuff, the impressions that come straight from mm-hmm. the senses. And in fact, I think Hume, definitely Hutchinson, I'm forgetting where I read this, wanted to say specifically, you don't want to confuse impressions with the specific five sense organs. Mm-hmm. Like there are plenty of impressions that we have that we can't identify as this is a smell or this is a color that is given to us. So you could have an impression of the moral value mm-hmm. of something. Yeah. And it's just a certain kind of special feeling that you get. And we might not even be able to put into other words exactly what that feeling is or how it differs from other feelings. Though we could talk about patterns of what kind of stuff in general causes us to have that feeling. But the quality of the feeling itself, the feeling is somehow elemental.
Some impressions are going to feel more or less. The will, for example, is the example that Hume uses the will as the most potent impression that we have.
And then part of his psychological theory, right, is that people act, and I think this is mostly from Hobbes, smashed in with Hume's epistemology, but people act in response to, well, motives, but motives then are a certain mm-hmm. kind of impression, right? It can't be something feeble. A little idea sitting back there is not going to actually motivate us to do something. Now, we could figure out a matter of fact, an idea, and that would trigger some impression, mm-hmm. some motive that is already there. So I might logically deduce that my wife is cheating on me or something, mm-hmm. but that in itself would not make me do anything. It's only because I have this antecedent desire for that not to happen. So desires and the will, yeah. all these things are impressions, and those are the things that actually push us and move mm-hmm. us. And so
exactly.
no verdict of reason could be a motivator. So therefore, morality can't be a verdict of reason.
Right.
And I think that's one of the compelling points. Hume makes the point that reason can never compel you to action, that there's always something else you have to add to an idea or to something arrived at via reason in order to get action. And to me, that's a very insightful comment. It says a lot about the rationalist enterprise. When you look at rationalist systems, not just for ethics, but also the enterprise of philosophy insofar as it's an exercise in reason. And a lot of times you end up saying, and so what? What am I supposed to do? Why is this interesting, right? And the fact of the matter is that what we find interesting, what it is that motivates us to talk about things, why we get passionate about things, why ideas matter, has nothing to do with reason. It has to do with something else, which in turn makes the question interesting of why is that particular thing of interest to you? And why are you passionate about it? And why do you care?
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. And another way of saying it is that you always have to make reference to the desire of the agent if you're talking about motivation. Morality has to be motivating, and you could take some fact of the matter, like there's a big juicy apple on the table, any descriptive fact like that. But to get to the motivating element, you always have to refer back to the desire of the agent. And so you'll never derive the motivating and therefore moral element just out of the descriptive fact. And the other angle, for Hume, reason judges of facts or relations of ideas, which is like saying the a posteriori empirical and the a priori relations of ideas, like for instance, mathematics is a matter of relations of ideas. You know, I think many of the rationalists went the route of talking about morality as akin to mathematics. And for Hume, that fails as well, because any relations that you can talk about, they apply just as much to animals or inanimate objects as they would to human beings. So, for instance, the acorn falling, the idea is you could take, say, a simpler example of one animal killing another animal, and that relation in of itself can't be described as moral. It's not the relation itself that gives you the moral quality. We wouldn't talk about one animal killing another as being a moral issue, even though we would with human beings. It must be something more than the simple state of affairs there that gives rise to the moral element. And that'll come down to sympathy and approbation and those sorts of concepts.
Well, let's chase that down for a second, because I think that's good to have that example on the table. So, right, Hume's response to that, or Smith's response to that, is it's not the relation of objects that we're witnessing, that we're talking about, one animal mm-hmm. killing another animal. It's the fact that this inspires in us seeing this murder a special feeling. And the feeling is different when it's two animals or when it's a person doing something. Okay, but the obvious response to that is it's not just the feeling. The feeling is based on something. It is based on an apprehension that in the case of a person killing, that person has certain intentions and has a sort of a required level of reflection and reason to be a member of the moral community, whatever. You know, it's not just the killing or the desire to kill. Maybe you want to say animals have desires to kill, but it's the freedom or whatever we want to say is going into making it a moral choice. Why is Hume's interpretation better than that more sort of common sense interpretation of the difference?
The common sense interpretation being?
Being that it's because of the agency of the person that is the difference. It's not our reaction to it. It still has to do with the event that you are witnessing.
This is one of the objections he brings up where you could say, well, why not appeal to free will of the agent?
Hume says we have to bring in the spectator for it to be a moral action. Right. If you just had somebody alone on an island going around and then another person somehow is there and the first person kills the second person, well, would that be immoral in itself? If there's no third person, it seems like you haven't developed the moral. I'm not sure exactly what to say. Hume would have to say that is not murder because there's no spectator. There's no community to judge it. But yet, maybe this person, I don't know, it's a problematic example because how would the person alone on an island who's never seen another person understand that this is a rational being that he's killing or something? So it's problematic to try to pull the spectator out of the situation. But I guess the question is, does the source of the value lie in the spectator's reaction? Yes, the spectator is reacting to what he imagines the motives of the actor are. That is part of it. But is it really, do we have to talk about the spectator at all in saying that it's moral, or can we just refer to the motives?
Well, I'm looking at page 16.
What section?
Treatise, book 3, part 1, section 1. A little bit into it.
This is where I think he brings up the free will objection and then responds to it.
Right, so he brings up that example. We say killing your father is bad, okay, but think about a tree drops an acorn, and the acorn grows into a tree that completely smothers out its parent tree. So that's the same relation as parricide, but of course that's not moral evil. So he says, it is not sufficient to reply that a choice or will is wanting. For in the case of parricide, a will does not give rise to any different relations, but is only the cause from which the action is derived, and consequently produces the same relations that in the oak or elm arise from some other principles. It is a will or choice that determines a man to kill his parent, and they are the laws of matter and motion that determine a sapling to destroy the oak from which it has sprung. Here, then, the same relations have different causes, but still the relations are the same. And as their discovery is not, in both cases, attended with the notion of immorality, it follows that the notion does not arise from such a discovery. Now, I don't know if that response relies on his peculiar account of free will.
It does. Yeah.
Yes.
So, because physical and moral necessity are the same thing for him. So, when he's talking about the will causing things, it causes things just like gravity causes a rock to fall. But the only difference in the case with the agents or human beings is that it's a particular kind of cause, namely one that flows from some agent's motive or desire to do something. So that is what makes the two cases different, is that in one case, it's the type of cause that flows from some person's motive, even though it's equally as necessary as the other one.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So if we get rid of that, I'm tempted to bring in Kant just because he's the person we talked about the most on this podcast, but let's not use him. As one of the rationalists would say, you know, God gives us free will. And you, Hume, your Hobbesian account of mental determinism is just messed up. And so I don't know if he has a response to that other than go read my epistemology for the reason why I hold this psychological view.
I think that's right. There's just kind of an impasse at this point.
Maybe Smith can save us here, right? Because Smith does not have that same view. And in fact, what I read in this online introduction to the Smith book was, yeah, Smith doesn't deal with this rationalism versus moral sentiment thing because sort of by his time, which of course is only 20 years after Hume is writing his, it was already, in his mind at least, a done deal. But then I found in the Smith book here, somewhere far into the Smith book beyond where we read, I have a quote where he says something to the effect of, whatever we believe about the basis of moral faculties, either certain work by reason, a basic instinct called a moral sense, or some other source in our nature, it can't be doubted that these faculties were given to us for the direction of our conduct in life. They bring with them the most obvious badges of this authority, signifying that they were set up within us to be the supreme deciders of all our actions, to superintend all our senses, passions and appetites, and to judge how far each of them should be indulged or restrained. In other words, he's saying, I don't even care. Like, maybe we do get these things from reason. Uh-huh. And he certainly says in that same chapter, this is a chapter on sort of the relation of morality to religion. It's clear that he says throughout the rest of this that we know about morality because of something like the moral sense, right? Because we reflect on the fact that we approve of this, which is, right, the same thing that Hume is saying. We look at the acorn in the tree and we don't have any reaction like that. And that's ultimately how we build up these general moral rules. But Smith, beyond that, says, yeah, you know, once we build these moral rules, we can see through the light of reason that they were correct. And in fact, that these are given to us by the creator to make us awesome. And so for Smith, he really has this overdetermined, even though 90% of what he says sounds very much like Hume, at least in that chapter, he's saying, yeah, you could get this from reason too. What, you know, who cares? And he doesn't seem to be committed.
That might just be political necessity, though, to have to say something like that.
Well, it's a long chapter and it seems like he's just not committed to this sort of determinism. He just doesn't talk about the epistemology and the metaphysics in the way that Hume does throughout this whole work. It's all about, fine, wherever these sentiments come from, wherever these thoughts that we have, like, here's the content of them and here's what we think about them when we think harder about them, etc. So let's bring Smith then into this question. Smith also thinks that you have to have the spectator there. We all have these reactions to things. And then the question is, do we then, when we reflect on our own reactions to them, do we approve of those reactions? Mm-hmm. And if so, then it was a moral action.
You're talking about the disinterested spectator thing where you...
Yes.
Is that reason or is that the point of empathy is that you're putting yourself into a similar position, not necessarily into the shoes of the particular person, but you're imagining what it would be like. And not even just for you to be in that situation, but for any given human being to be in that situation. Mm-hmm. So it's still an empathetic exercise. It's just a more generalized version. It doesn't make it reasoning in the sense that Hume wants to think about.
But is he committed to Hume's determinism in having this sort of thought that this is where we get our moral sentiments?
No, not at all. Not at all.
But yet he still brings the spectator in. So there's where it seems to rest.
It functions differently for Hume and for Smith. For Smith, it seems to be a kind of a tool by which we are able to make more correct or proper moral judgments about situations because we're able to get to the sort of right proximity from the situation. We don't want to be too close, but we don't want to be so far away so that we don't feel any sort of sense of sympathy. But for Hume, we just make moral judgments necessarily from a general point of view. So when we call something good or bad, it's always from the position of a first person plural. That's just how the moral judgment works for Hume, as opposed to Smith, it seems to be something that we use.
Moral sense for both Hume and Smith, it can't be something simple. It can't be just this, you know, a light goes on and that's moral, because that would just be this subjectivism. Well, for both Hume and Smith, it's more complicated than that. Yes, it's all sensations, but there's multiple sensations to a variety of different things that we have at different times, that a variety of different people have, so that you would expect people to get better at this as they gain more experience, sort of gain wisdom in general, where that's not just defined as having more acute moral sentiments, but in a non-moral sense, it's defined as being more of a wise man of the world who understands the way things work.
Yeah, Hume is more complicated. You can see that in Smith more. Smith, I think it's useful to think of the impartial spectator as something like second-order desires. So it's the idea that we have desires about desires and that the impartial spectator is able to sort of judge the desires that we have, sort of like how we normally talk about something like conscience. So conscience is something that stands above the kind of desires that we have, the sort of more basic or first order desires, and is able to make judgments about the desires that we have and whether or not they fit properly to the situation. And that seems to definitely be going on in Smith.
So can we just sum up now? We've got both the views on the table. So Hume is just saying we have this reaction to things, and that's what motivates us to rate something positively or negatively. And in fact, Wes was arguing at the beginning that it's really what morality is this act of rating. It's not that there's a fact of the matter that this is evil, and so that's why we react to it. It's the rating itself that is what morality is all about. And so if we want to come up with a moral system, if we want to come up with moral rules, it's just a matter of looking for regularities in how we react to different things in different circumstances. It's the fact that we share that with everybody else. You don't share my ambition for my goals, right? You have your own ambition for your goals, but I have some benevolence for the whole human race or for everybody that I, you know, at least run into, have significant dealings with. You too have that. So that's something socially that we have in common. So that gives us the groundwork for actually building an ethical system. So it's a social construct based on these private feelings that we can share and communicate with each other, right? Any changes to that overview of,
well, you,
of Hume there?
You were talking about facts of the matter. I think Hume is consistent with there being facts of the matter about morality. It's just that those facts aren't empirical facts and they're not mathematical truths. That seems to be the implication from other things that we didn't read.
Well, if you say that just like there are, okay, money is a social creation, but certainly once we've established that, then there are facts of the matter exactly. in the system about what counts as money and how much this thing is worth. So let's just say the source materials from which morality is derived are all these basic sentiments. And yes, okay, there's a fact that you had that sentiment. There's that kind of fact, all right, but that's not...
No, I'm not saying that when you say that murder is wrong, I think you can still be a moral realist and accept...
Where do you get in Hume the idea? I think my analogy with money works pretty well. And I thought that's what he was going after. That's the relativist interpretation.
That's a constructivist approach that Hume, I don't even think Hume is.
But I think that's exactly the line that Hume's going to take, though. And I think Marx's example of the money, but earlier, the taxonomy of like how we react to things. So it's a matter of fact that the way that we as a sort of moral community, we react to certain things in a certain way. And it is a matter of fact that we do it as such. So what seems to be the case for Hume and also for Smith is just kind of doing a taxonomy of how we react to things. And these things are socially constructed in some way. Now, there's the difference between, we read a little bit about the natural virtues, if I remember correctly. So there's going to be some of that. There's going to be some of these kind of like basic notions of sympathy, which are going to be more or less degree based on how close we are to one another. But most of the things that are important about morality are things that are built up over time that are, in Hume's terms, artificial, so that they are socially constructed, but not through any sort of like pre-planned purpose, but through our just sort of small interactions with each other as it sort of comes to be.
Social construction gets you still to a moral fact of the matter.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, totally.
Let's use Hume's distinction between the natural and artificial virtues that you referred to, Getty, to sort of get us out of this, you know, what's right and what's wrong about the money example, that pleasantness is a natural virtue, right? Beneficence is a natural virtue. And those are just things that when we behold somebody acting like that, we just approve of that. And that's not going to vary by culture. Maybe in details, but he doesn't really get into that, at least in what we read. So a good chunk of this third treatise is kind of like his version of social contract theory. He's trying to say how a lot of the rest of morality, like justice and promise keeping and things, is actually this socially constructed like you were talking about, right? And he specifically says, it's like when two guys are in a rowboat and one rows on the right side with the expectation that the other is going to row on the left side too. It's not that they made a contract to do it. It's just that this works well when both people do it together. So we have this sort of interest in, and so he gives his version of Hobbes' state of nature, Rousseau's state of nature, which we were not going to go into and we didn't read much of. The idea just being that there's this whole edifice of justice, say, which constitutes, you know, a lot of what we consider morality and a lot of the actual motivation. So just the idea that morality is ultimately based on sentiment doesn't mean that every time we do something morally, we're just doing it because we have a sentiment to do so. Mm-hmm. Like we could really, like Kant thinks, be doing it for the sake of duty. But it's just that that is a logically posterior. That comes after this sort of edifice is built up based on these natural moral sentiments.
Yes.
So we all, yeah, we all have the natural sentiment to look after our own interests. We have this natural sentiment to really look after the interests of our immediate families, really just about as strongly as our own interests. And then eventually, you could call it a meme, the idea comes up that cooperating with others for mutual benefit is a good thing. And so justice is sort of the primary means of doing that. And property is, you know, something that arises at the same time. And so all these things are artificial. They really are social constructs put in the proper perspective. That doesn't mean they're arbitrary.
It's artificial for me, but it's artificial arising out of the sort of natural interactions that we already have. So in some sense, it's not artificial. It's also natural. Whereas you get the sense with someone like Hobbes and Locke that it is artificial in the sense that it doesn't arise naturally. We have to come together and sort of calculate each other's mutual respect. I think the rowboat example is good, but the whole point with Hume is that we never decide to get in the rowboat. We are always already in the rowboat. And this is the sort of criticism of the social contract theory, is that we already find ourselves in society working out these kinds of norms together. And this is actually where I see the kind of tie with someone like Hegel. And there's actually a lot of interesting back and forth between what Hume and Smith and what some of the Scots are doing and what someone like Hegel is doing in the way that they view the sort of progression of society. So that's, I think, the way that Hume is taking the artificial virtues. They're only virtues insofar as they depend on the relations between the people in society, but they are naturally arising.
The thing that struck me most about the Hume, and this is kind of the theme of why we read this, was that at one point he talks about perceptions versus ideas, and he says, you know, morality is not an idea. It's not a matter of fact. It's not a subject of reason. And I find that particularly striking. Both Hume and Smith talk about the action itself or an action itself, and then the morality of the action being somehow in the perception of the individual.
That's the foundation for it, right?
That's the foundation for it.
The system is then a social enterprise. We talk about these. Yep.
Right. So we have to somehow, if not bridge, then at least explain or understand how this faculty or sentiment is somehow connected to the social enterprise. And it's not simply, I won't say relative, but socially relative. That there's more weight to it than simply, this is what everybody thinks, so this is what I should think.
Yep.
And I don't know if I'm either recapping or dumbing it down too much, but that seems to me to be the critical question.
Yeah, no, I think that's a real concern. I think some of it, you have the natural virtues are based on pleasure and pain. So things like love and such are just more complicated versions of pleasure and pain, which of course is problematic. But most things aren't the natural virtues. Most things are the artificial virtues. So yeah, it becomes a real question as to what else is there to it other than that's what we all think.
So part of the reason why this is kind of working on me right now is that I've been reading and trying to do some meditation, and I've been studying on some of this, I guess you could call it Eastern, right? The whole idea of not being attached to the valuation of things. So there are events or activities that people do and your own feelings and perceptions, you should recognize them, but you don't want to be attached to them. Recognize they're temporary and let them go. So there's a lot in both of these texts that's sympathetic to that view to a certain extent. Let's take an example of you're driving on the highway and somebody cuts you off. You're on your way to work and somebody cuts you off. You get to work and you go, God, people are just terrible drivers. I can't, and somebody else in there says, I know it, man. It's awful. I can't believe they give these people driver's licenses, right? So if like 9 of the 10 people you meet say, you're right, it's unbelievable that it's so easy to get a driver's license and people are so inconsiderate, right? They're in a sense validating both the activity or the action as well as your reaction to the action, right? Because part of both of these, certainly in Smith, there's a sense in which there's an appropriate reaction to the severity or the level of the wrong that's been done to you, right? Mm-hmm. So you go, well, I must be reacting to this properly because 9 of the 10 people I met hate people who cut you off on I-35. So the 10th person you meet, it just happens to be me. And I go, dude, what do you expect? Like if you leave the door of your house in the morning just expecting that people are going to act this way, then you won't be surprised and get upset when it happens. You just need to like let that go. Mm-hmm. Now, am I acting inappropriately because I do not have the same amount of moral indignation, or I won't say moral, the same amount of indignation that you've been wronged? Am I out of step with these other 9 people and with the majority of society in such a way that you could say that my moral sentiment is malformed or incorrect? And this is kind of like a very practical set of things that I kept thinking of examples as I was reading this about things that make me upset and things that make other people upset that I don't share the same sense of. And can I be said then to not have the right moral sentiment?
according to Smith.
Yeah.
I think that
was a real concern for me. It reminds me of the utilitarianism discussion where I was like, in theory, I like this, but in practice, there's no way to do any kind of utilitarian calculus. So I'm concerned about this sense in which there's somehow supposed to be alignment amongst all right-thinking members of the society that certain things have a requisite response and certain things have a different kind of response. And if you don't have the same amount of indignation. Now, the examples he gives are hard to argue with, right? He talks about unconscionable murderers and all sorts of bad. And I think there's a legitimate question about whether or not culturally there are norms where the examples he gives are the same. But how do we take somebody who, let's say, is Christ-like? It seems to me that in Smith's view, the wrong of having something being stolen from you entitles you to a certain amount of indignation, which if you don't feel because you're not attached to those things or because you realize that the person who took it is poor or whatever the case may be, you're somehow out of step. It's somehow wrong that you don't feel the same things that other people feel.
Yeah, he's just reflecting, like, don't you know people that get pushed around a lot? And don't those kind of people irritate you who just let themselves be pushed around? Like, come on, raise yourself a little bit. It's not like you would so condemn such a person that lets them be pushed around that you think they deserve punishment or something. But in terms of how much do you want to praise them, they are not the optimal. And in fact, he gives an example further in to sort of complicate things where he talks about a Quaker. Like if you saw a Quaker who wants to turn the other cheek, but he actually loses his temper and strikes back at the guy that's being mean to him, you would cheer for the Quaker and kind of laugh at him. You wouldn't praise him to the extent that you would somebody who just righteously takes his revenge to the appropriate moderate amount, according to Smith. But still, you would praise him. It's just that the Quaker is acting under faulty morals. So Smith actually does address this, and specifically how religion can, you know, gives examples of different plays in which, in fact, it mentions this, a play called something like Mohammed by Voltaire. Mm-hmm. That is about a boy and a girl that their patron, this old man that's really nice to them, but their religion tells them that they have to kill this guy, that they have to murder him. And so they struggle with that. And only after they actually do it, do they realize that they'd been duped and that this was a false religion telling them to do this thing. You know, and so we should be sort of easier on them because it's easy to be screwed over by false beliefs injected upon you by some sect or something like that. But it's still wrong. We still would have to punish it. Ignorance is no excuse. And the fact that they were so, in the play, hesitant to do this, that their own sentiments cried out against this, meant they should have known better. We all have consciences that tell us the right thing. It's just that the conscience isn't universal in the details.
Yeah.
So he has this whole chapter that this is part of. It's part 5 in his book that's about moral relativism, essentially, that's saying, look, in different circumstances in history, people develop a different kinds of temperaments. Mm-hmm. So even though in the first part of this book, Smith has been very judgmental about having the proper amount of indignation and not too much, and not too little towards something and sounding very stoical and saying how awesome it is to have something horrible happen to you and yet to bear up and not show emotion and all these kind of, like, really, that's your universe, that's your moral standard, and I'm wrong if I disagree with that.
But he says a lot of things that make a lot of sense in that same context, where he talks about how you naturally have a different and closer affinity for your children than you do for your, what is it, your it goes from your child to your nephew to your cousin. Like, there's a chain of, you know, relationships that, all of which makes sense. And he even says earlier on in the book, he talks about how you want to be around friends and that the fact that people live by themselves or are isolated when they need human contact and they need sociality is the best remedy for despair. And all of which rings very true to me. I mean, I think it's very insightful. It's just this kind of like, we're all on board for the same practical set of moral guidance that I find difficult.
Yeah, so in part 5, he does say, look, in a different culture where things are much harsher, so he says that the Native American cultures, you know, things are much harsher there. One false slip and you're dead in those cultures. So the sort of emotional expression that we would tolerate in our culture, like they would just clamp right down on. But on the other hand, they're much more savage when it comes to actually taking their revenge. It's just that they're just going to, you know, gives this example of a girl who's disappointed her mother and just saying, you have no child anymore. And she goes and drowns herself. For their culture, it makes sense. And even just says for different roles in our culture, the young versus the old, whatever, people are going to have different sensibilities. So he acknowledges that a lot of what he said really is particular to upper class British, Scottish society of his time.
Well, he could have thrown that caveat out at the beginning of the book.
You'd think so.
The trouble.
You'd think so. He doesn't, because he thinks that they don't differ in the most important general principles. No culture says beneficence is bad. We all feel good when somebody's nice to you.
Yes. So maybe we should bring the conversation back to that then. Because obviously, even within the same culture, children are not held accountable for the same things as adults, right? So there is some kind of variance. And a culture that didn't have a notion of property, like the American Indian, right, from their perspective over there, obviously wouldn't have the same notion of theft, right? It wouldn't work the same way. But the key fundamental insight that Smith brings in this book is that sympathy is universal. Mm-hmm. That regardless of what culture you're in or what sort of cultural norms there are, when you have a relationship with somebody, you are happy to see them do well, and it pains you to see them do poorly or to have ill done to them. Mm-hmm. And that you use your imagination and your faculty of sympathy to put yourself in their position, or you naturally imagine what they're going through, and it makes you feel good or bad. And that without sympathy, there are no grounds for any kind of moral community at all. If you don't give a shit about the other person in any way, shape, or form, there is no moral community whatsoever. And that's, I think, powerful.
It is powerful. And I think also, just to be fair to Smith more so, because I think, Seth, your criticism actually works even more on Hume, because the kind of Stoic line stuff about self-command, that actually gives a conceptual space for someone to train their sentiments in the right way. So in this kind of situation where you get cut off or whatever, you can learn to not get as angry and feel the kind of indignation for Smith, because it's actually good to kind of keep these passions in order and oriented in the right way. Hume doesn't have that, which a lot of people say that's why Smith has a more sophisticated moral theory, because there's actually this sense in which Smith recognizes that not all of the kind of reactions that we have to these situations are always the best kind of reactions, and that we have to sort of work on ourselves in some way, where Hume does not say that. So I think it's important to see the kind of role that something like self-command, or the awful virtues, as he calls them, are playing in the system.
I didn't get a lot of flavor from Hume, you know, sort of what the content of his ethics really was. I mean, yes, we naturally approve of beneficence and things like that, which for Hutcheson, everything gets reduced to beneficence. And then when we get to the artificial virtues, which is sort of most of the game of morality, of admiring justice and things, then he explicitly brings in utility, right? That, again, morality is founded on my self-love and my limited love for my family and my immediate surroundings. But because it's sort of in our interests to then expand this out and create this system, then we do so. That's a reflection of utility, and that utility just in general pleases us. Again, that's just another look at your gut reactions. When you see that something is favoring most people most of the time, and incidentally that Bentham's calculus there, right, do the most happiness for the greatest people, is actually right from Hutcheson. Hutcheson invented that, at least according to this British moralist's thing. So there's a direct line here to utilitarianism. But anyway, that's sort of the most flavor that I got out of what the content of Hume's ethics was, where with Smith, you know, we get all these awesome details and anecdotes, maybe to the point of much too specific.
Yeah, and actually, so it's disturbing when we didn't read a lot of the content stuff for Hume, but Hume doesn't even have the conceptual resources to distinguish between natural talents and virtues. So we might feel the same amount of approbation towards someone's dexterity as towards their virtue. And there's really no difference for Hume between those two things, where there obviously is for Smith. So that can be kind of a problem.
You think that's a bad thing for Hume?
That's a bad thing for Hume, because I think naturally, I mean, we kind of want to distinguish between a virtue, which is something that someone develops over time as a result of someone's trying to do something, whereas a natural talent is not something that someone is responsible for necessarily. So we're not going to keep approbation on someone that can run fast necessarily. We might.
Yeah, but that's not the examples he gives. He gives these mental virtues like courage and prudence, that those are certainly not just a matter of choosing something. It's not purely a matter of free will. There's natural talent right there in the virtue.
There is, But there's other examples of natural talents that he uses. For example, wit. So someone's wit is a virtue for him, just as much as something like self-command would be. They're of the same type. They just might differ in slightly in degree as far as how much we have approbation towards it. I'm not saying that it's like totally an issue. I'm just saying that a lot of people tend to point that out as kind of counterintuitive to say that wit is on the same level. Because wit, I mean, for someone like Kant, wit's going to be something that's totally morally neutral. Whereas for Hume, it doesn't seem to be the case that it is.
Just a straight line from Aristotle to Nietzsche, man. Right through this dude.
So I like Smith a lot. That's what I'm trying to say.
All right. So we don't have much of the beef of things from Hume, but Smith gives us quite a lot. And we've mentioned the impartial spectator, but let's just sort of recap that so we can evaluate that. Somebody want to take a stab at what that is exactly?
All right. So at some point towards the middle of the book, I'm not even sure where it is. I think I might revisit my Kindle strategy for these readings. In order to make a judgment, if you will, about whether you are responding both appropriately and to the appropriate degree to any particular action that you undertake, Smith suggests that you treat yourself in two ways, that there's the you that's doing the thing, and then there's you step outside of yourself and sort of look upon yourself as an impartial spectator. And the intent is that you are supposed to kind of view yourself as others would, with the idea of being able to get at this socially constructed moral sentiment and be able to judge whether what you're doing is appropriate or inappropriate. However, to do this, he suggests, it's not something you do in the moment. He suggested something that you do after your passions have settled down and you've calmed down a little bit, and that you create the ability, if you will, to look at yourself neutrally and make that judgment.
Right. Morality is fundamentally about judging other people, having reactions to things you witness. And then in order to turn that on yourself, you have to realize other people judge you too, and sort of pretend you're them.
He suggests that you can have this position of sympathy. You can be sympathetic to somebody else, but it's almost like when you try to turn that back on yourself, that you need to be able to take this step. It takes the place of putting yourself in somebody else's shoes and looking at you, or like asking them, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And it's not even just, you know, imagining what somebody else would think, because it's imagining what somebody else who had all the relevant knowledge that you have, which most people are not going to. They're not really going to know the secret springs of your motivation, but like try to be impartial, but yet retain that knowledge. So it becomes like this ideal spectator, not even just imagining another person, which means it's difficult to do, right? To be impartial enough to yourself. Yeah. It is a skill in itself.
There's a developmental story. So I think in one of the parts that we didn't read, he lays out development of how we come to understand this idea of an impartial spectator. So it's something that we develop over time, being able to sort of understand what an impartial spectator would say or do in a certain circumstance. And we only come to like comport ourselves towards that over time through training ourselves. But I think, too, it's also important to say that even though they're impartial in a sense, like they're still, it's not like a ideal in the sense that they're totally standing above all of the norms and judging them and so on. They're still within that system. They're just like the sage or something like this, where they're just like the best of us, but they're still part of us.
Well, this is what made me want to connect this to modern philosophical naturalism. The guy that I did my undergrad thesis under at University of Michigan, Peter Railton.
Oh.
Was
I thought you were about to talk about Bergman again.
No. Peter Railton, he was explicitly an ethical naturalist, and his theory was something like, what is good for me is what I would decide to do if I had all the relevant information, right? So it's this abstraction, it's to this ideal, but it uses only sort of down-to-earth things, and that was sort of the foundation of his talking about ethics. Reading Smith about that really brought that back. You know, it's still entirely within, it's not bringing in anything, as you say, ideal in the Platonic or Christian or anything like that form. It's just imagining that you are smarter than you are.
Does he even really need the impartial spectator? Because when you have a socially constructed moral sense, or you're part of the society, you're going to get pretty immediate feedback, aren't you, on what you're doing? Is this his mechanism for how to deal with moral issues when you're struggling with them internally prior to acting out?
I think so.
Because I think as soon as you act out and you do anything, you'll get immediate feedback, or pretty immediate feedback, from others in society, and you'll know pretty well by their reaction whether what you've done is appropriate or not. And they're, by the way, not impartial, right? They're impartial relative, I guess, to the norm. But the reality
is... impartial relative to your particular situation.
It's important that you're not just reacting to the disapprobation of others, though, with morality, right?
True. But what I'm saying is that, what does the impartial observer do for you that just looking in the faces of other people when you do something doesn't tell you?
Because there is an ideal that other people could be just be full of crap.
Yeah.
And if this part of the self-possession and stoical calm and stuff is not sort of giving in to the mob, that actually true virtue could be something quite rare and the mass could have really poor taste. I think he leaves it open to that, that we can found morality on sentiment without it becoming crass and sort of whatever the majority says.
And conceivably, you could be hanging out with the wrong crowd, or you could have been badly conditioned, right, and have all sorts of become viceful by responding to the approval of people who encourage you to be that way, but still have some innate ability where you could conceivably tap into what the right thing to do would be. So, for instance, suppose you've been poorly conditioned, and there's still some innate ability when you see an act of injustice, let's say, to identify it as unjust. I don't know if that ever goes away, I guess, unless you're a sociopath, which I'm not sure how these theories deal with.
So, Getty, you're going to have to help me out here. I'm hearing two possibilities. One is, what I'm saying is, let's say that you learn that your father has passed away, mm-hmm. and you kind of fall into histrionics, right? You start crying and whatever. And you look around you, and the people you know, you tell them, my father passed away, and they look at you like, you're kind of overreacting, dude, right? Mm-hmm. So,
which happens so often.
I'm just... pick another example, right? But
no, that's okay. Go ahead.
So one way that you could say the impartial observer, right, is you say, okay, what I'm seeing in these other people tells me that my reaction is out of step with whatever the norm is, because they're not showing the same level of sympathy for me that I expect that they should show. Mm-hmm. So I use the impartial observer to step outside of myself and say, am I overreacting to this situation? And then you can say, somehow there's a way that that mechanism allows you to judge between whether you are acting appropriately and everybody else is just screwed up, or whether you're acting inappropriately because they're not. That's one way that you could imagine this. Mm-hmm. What Getty and I were, I think, aligned on just a little bit earlier was the impartial observer could also be a mechanism for if you are debating about an action to take, what is the right action? And maybe there's some question in your mind. The impartial observer is a mechanism by which you can adjudicate prior to the action and say, okay, this is the right thing to do, or this is how this will be received, and this is what is appropriate, and this is not what is appropriate. Mm-hmm. I was thinking it was the latter.
I tend to agree. Most of the times that it's talked about, it seems as a kind of heuristic that we use to decide what a right action will be or how to react to a situation. Sometimes Smith refers to the impartial spectator as the man within the breast. So it seems like it's something like conscience, which usually is used in circumstances where there's some kind of dilemma. So I think the latter interpretation is the way that I usually take it.
That's interesting. Like, how could this man in the breast, how could this impartial observer work to validate or invalidate the moral norms of the society? How would somebody have a crisis of conscience where they would question the rightness or wrongness or the appropriateness, the approbation or disapprobation of the action of somebody else outside of the context of the socially constructed norm itself? How does this impartial observer get outside of that?
Well, the social construction has to come from somewhere, right? It comes from this natural empathetic ability. So there's a back and forth. It's not like just some arbitrary social construction comes from somewhere and then we adhere to it. The social construction on the whole is going to be a reflection of something innate. What I'm saying is that it's conceivable that there could be some conflict between what one particular society requires. Let's say if something has gone wrong, it's not the case that some group of people, that any set of values that a group adheres to is morally right. I'm just arguing against the relativist position here.
I don't think Smith, from the chapter that, you know, where he's relating it to the divine and things, I don't think he's ultimately a relativist, that he's a providential naturalist was a term I ran into.
I saw that.
Secondary reading, which is like back to Aristotle, looking at the sort of teleology of human nature, that we all have an excellence built within us. Well, the providential part is God has set things up in us. So you could say God has given us this moral sense,
right,
which serves us well, which serves us. It's useful to us. It doesn't lead us astray if we pay attention to it. So there's something about this man within the breast that is maybe not purely just a reflection of what other people think. Like, we get it by looking at what other people, but since other people are all reacting based on this same underlying God-given teleology, in some ways our moral sentiments are determined, then we can maybe reflect on our own conscience and maybe come up with something superior to the examples that have been presented to us.
Yeah, and we could take out the providential part of that, right? It's conceivable that we could have been so constituted as to be naturally viceful, and that's where the providence gets you around that. God sets it up nicely. But if we wanted a purely, getting back to naturalism, naturalist position, we'd have to get rid of that.
Right. No, that's exactly where you start talking about evolution and memes and all that stuff, and that's why Churchland and the like are following that route for exactly that reason. How do you explain the providential character of that without actually bringing in God having plans for us and setting this up in such a nice way?
Yeah, you can just say, okay, so morality is based on a sentiment, and it just happens to be a matter of fact that everyone shares the same sentiments, or at least the same fundamental ones that can at least get the project off the ground, in particular, sympathy. So you don't need God for those kinds of cases, but the worry is that if you don't have God, it's not able to kind of obligate in the same sort of strong and absolute manner.
Right. Mm-hmm. There are lots of problems you'll run into in trying to, again, if you want to be a moral realist, I think that you're going to run into lots of problems with this whole system. How you ultimately get to moral facts and how you escape relativism and all that, I think it's tricky. I'm not sure that it can be done.
I think we might want to talk about the transition in Smith between parts one and part two, because a lot of the examples, even though we're talking about morality here, the examples that Seth just brought up, for instance, was all about, like, am I feeling the right level of grief for my father passing? And that seemed just strange in a moral discussion. But I think that gives a lot of insight into how Smith puts his theory together, that his whole first part, which is really long, which is a lot of what we read, is all about propriety. And it's about sympathizing with other people, which we're sympathizing is not just feeling bad for them. It's if they feel bad, we feel bad. If they feel good, we feel good. If they are condemning something, we condemning it too. Sympathizing is joining in with them. It's feeling an echo of what we conceive them to be feeling in ourselves. And he goes in all these details about how it's not actual sympathy. Like, we feel bad when somebody is dead for the dead person, even though obviously the dead person is not feeling bad. The dead person is dead. We imaginatively project ourselves into that situation, you know, the way we are now. And, oh, all those things the person is missing out on. Wow, I feel bad for that dead person. And that's a prime example. So it's not just purely connectiveness between people. It's this imaginative act. And once he set up that that's how propriety works, then he can move on to talking about merit and demerit. And that's where the second order desires come in. So it's not even just feeling sympathetic towards someone. It's when we reflect on our sympathy later, do we approve of it or not? He creates these kind of complicated structures of sympathy for why do we sympathize with somebody who's feeling gratitude and who's acting appropriately in response to the kindness that has been done for them? Well, because we think about the motive of the person who did the action. Was it actually beneficent or was it just an accident? Mm-hmm. And we don't think the person should feel gratitude if it was just an accident or the person is really doing it for a selfish reason. We cue in on the motive of the person who's doing it. We also cue in on the actual gratitude of the person who at least should be feeling gracious at this point. So it's a double reflection. It's the same thing with resentments. We do not sympathize with this bad motive that the person had in doing this, but then we also sympathize with the bad reaction that the victim has against the aggressor. So that spurs us. Once we open ourselves up to sympathy, is not just a matter of sort of this one-dimensional feeling an echo of what somebody else is feeling, because he thinks even women even women can feel that. but they're not sophisticated enough to sort of be truly generous, to truly put somebody else's interests ahead of their own. Or, you know, he has lots of obnoxious things to say about why sympathy is not a girlish thing in the way he's talking about. The key move there is this abstraction, is this when you move to merit and demerit, you're not just talking about sympathy, you're talking about second order judgments about sympathy. And those require some sort of distance and maturity, manly reserve and objectivity to pull off correctly.
You put it in such an unfavorable way.
This is right after the feminism episode. I can't help myself.
I think it's an intuitive distinction. So it's the distinction between understanding where someone is coming from and doing something and recognizing their reaction to the situation is a good one. The propriety and impropriety bit is judging whether someone's feeling a certain way, whether you can understand how they feel towards something. But the merit and demerit is the sort of action that comes after that, whether their action is warranted. And I think that's a fairly intuitive distinction. He says the second paragraph of section one of part two, morality is two different relations. First is in relation to the cause or object which excites it, and secondly in relation to the end it proposes or to the effect that which it tends to produce. And that's the merit and demerit part. And yeah, it takes more reflection in a sense to see. I think it makes sense, the distinction.
So it's kind of like Hume talking about artificial virtues, and that lets him not say that we have a sentiment about all these individual things. Whereas Smith really does think that we all strongly have a sentiment. Somebody has done something unjust, that there's a prime sentiment for that. It's not artificial at all. But it does let him build some complexity into his theory that not everything is a gut reaction, or maybe saying that there's multiple parts to the gut reaction or multiple elements we have to look out for. So he has this whole section. I think maybe the very beginning of it is in the British Moralist section. But just that, even though our approbation of somebody's action is based on our assessment of their motive, still, we do look at the outcome. It shouldn't matter whether they're successful or not. If somebody's an attempted murderer or an actual murderer, it should be just as bad because they're just as wicked in the choice they made, if you're focusing just on the choice. But the fact is, we do regard it as worse when somebody successfully murders and when they just try to murder but are inept about it, or have there's an accident and something gets in the way. We could see in the latter case, maybe they took a wrong turn there, but now maybe they have, by luck, they have a chance to redeem themselves. They should still be punished in some way for this attempt, but really no harm done, man. So with appropriate counseling, they could get out of it. Whereas if they actually do the murder, I'm sorry, we have to cut off your head. Even though the content of your intention was not any different than this other dude who we're letting ultimately walk scot-free. Mm-hmm. I started by saying that that was a good point of complexity, but the... I'm not sure if my disparaging description made it sound like that.
That's especially where something like self-command is going to come in, though. Like, so we need to learn to act right. Someone can understand where we're coming from, but if we act incorrectly, if our action brings up bad consequences, that warrants demerit. And that's especially where we need to exercise self-command, is in the sort of actions that we take as a result of the sentiments. Mm-hmm. He's pretty hardline on some of this stuff.
After he's gone into the merit and demerit and things, he eventually does get back to sentiments, that he says, once you've analyzed your sentiments, you come up with these moral rules. And it's perfectly conceivable that someone could act morally, even though they don't have moral sentiments, because they just like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do, so I'm going to do that. And they do that because they have this socially taught code of action that they're supposed to follow, and they just do it. And there's nothing wrong with that. You don't necessarily deserve high praise on your moral wisdom if that's your approach. Something's going to ring false. If you're, oh, I'm only being nice to my kids because I'm supposed to, they're going to know. They're going to figure that out. So it eventually comes back to, so he considers this question in one of the later chapters on which motives are appropriate to which correct things. And so, yeah, care for your children. If you're doing it entirely out of obligation, there's something that's not in propriety. There's something messed up about that. But on the other hand, justice, even though, yes, we have a sentiment for justice, like really, no, we should be exact in our following the rules of justice. You should not let your particular sympathy with what's going on at the time sway you, because you might say, let murderers off the hook and not kill them, or say, oh, in this case, it doesn't hurt anybody if I rob from the rich, if I'm poor. This is a slippery slope for him. You can't make exceptions based on your sentiments with regard to justice. So in that sense, he's kind of like Hume in saying it's an artificial virtue, even though it's not artificial. Ultimately, the best way, the most appropriate way to act justly is going to be acting as if it's artificial, as if it's something that we're just doing as Kant would say, for the sake of duty.
Because the good of society rests on it. For Hume and Smith, I mean, justice, like, they're very anxious about it being very fixed. So it's very important that you follow the rules of justice, even if you don't have the right sort of sentiments towards it, because everything else hangs on it being the case that we have these rules that holds everything together.
So we have to have the death penalty.
Yes, Gordon Smith.
We might feel like a soldier that falls asleep on the job shouldn't be put to death, but we understand how important it is to set the precedent of obeying. So we really, sorry, put aside your womanish sentiments and put the person to death. Does that point out, say, something archaic about this whole view?
I don't know.
Did these guys ring true for you?
I like them a lot. The focus on empathy, I think, is right on.
Just while we're on the subject of justice, I will read from a section I know not where. It is 8% if you have the Kindle version that I have. He's talking about justice, and he's talking about the remoteness of justice versus the immediateness of your experience in moral life. And he says, "But it is the immediate and not the remote effects of objects which render them agreeable or disagreeable to the imagination. A prison is certainly more useful to the public than a palace. And the person who founds the one is generally directed by a much juster spirit of patriotism than he who builds the other. But the immediate effects of a prison, the confinement of the wretches shut up in it, are disagreeable. And the imagination either does not take time to trace out the remote ones or sees them at too great a distance to be much affected by them. Prison, therefore, will always be a disagreeable object, and the fitter it is for the purpose for which it was intended, it will be the more so." So justice, in a weird way, is kind of a mechanism by which we can overcome our, what you might call, immediate sympathies or possible immediate sympathies for what somebody who commits a crime is suffering at the hands of the state. That actually brings up an interesting question, I think. What happens when you have conflicting sympathies? He uses the example early on in the book of when somebody is violently angry and threatening somebody else. He says, before you know what it is that has caused this person to kind of go off the hook, your inclination is to be sympathetic to the people he's threatening as opposed to him because he's wildly out of control. But if you found out that the person he was threatening had just committed some heinous act to one of his loved ones, you might think, oh, well, in that case, he's perfectly within his rights. I'm using my imagination, and if I was his position, I might open up a can of whoop-ass also. Right? So there has to be a way in which your awareness or knowledge of the circumstances tempers your sympathy, which he does explicitly say that that's the case. But I find that very interesting, and I think it must somehow tie to this notion of justice, but I can't quite pull the threads together. It's like the more you know about a situation, the more your moral sense is going to hone in on where your sympathy should lie. Whereas the less you know, the more you'll probably be in question, or the more you'll likely respond to the situation as it seems to you at the time. But you have to be open to the idea that the more information that you get about the fact, if you will, or the action, that your moral sentiment may change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. It's the same for Hume as well. Hume points out that we can actually get our feelings of approval or disapproval wrong. He lists there two ways we can be wrong about the way that we judge things to be moral or immoral. And one of them is if we get the description of the action wrong or the circumstances. So I think that's the way Smith and Hume both deal with it in the same way. And it's important that they do that, right? Because otherwise, the way that we feel about things would just be the sort of like the last judge of what was actually right and wrong.
Let me make an analogy here back to our pragmatism discussion. So in that, we had William James, we had Charles Sanders Peirce, mm-hmm. and one of the ways of talking about the difference between them on truth was that for James, truth is ultimately somehow built out of actual judgments that people have. And yes, you could be wrong about those things, and there are ways sort of within experience that you could correct yourself. So there is room for improvement. It's not pure relativism, supposedly. But Peirce had very much more explicitly a more Kantian streak that truth is sort of what the ideal group of scientific observers will agree upon eventually when they study these things for an indefinite period of time. And I guess the analogy I want to draw maybe is that Hume and Smith are kind of like James and Peirce in that way. that I saw Humes as, just like you said, you could be wrong about things, but you're wrong about things not because your brute moral sentiments are wrong, but because you're wrong about the facts of the matter. You're misidentifying something, whatever. There's ways that wisdom could make you a better moral judge. But this whole idea with the impartial spectator and how that could transcend the actual judgments of the people around you. And interestingly, one of the introductions that I'll link people to said that the way he talks about the impartial spectator differs from the earlier versions of the theory of moral sentiments to the later versions. Yes. So then the earlier versions, yeah. So he's actually referring to actual other people more in the earlier versions. But then later, he makes it clear that's kind of some of this more ideal. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think this reflects, again, that Smith has this whole chapter about how ultimately, even though these things are built out of moral sentiments, what we're ultimately getting at are the laws of God, and we should call them the laws of God. And it has this very overarching universalist thing, whereas Hume is more indebted and comes from more the Hobbesian camp, where it's more straightforwardly naturalist. And really, there's ultimately not that sort of transcendent fact, the absolute moral fact that was their pre-existence of human to refer to in any sense.
Yeah, you got to take the God stuff seriously with Smith. And I think the only way it works is you have a kind of reestablished harmony in the Leibnizian sense between these kinds of things.
Could I, to work our way toward the end, just run through these five objections by John Ballguy, the rationalist, to the moral sentiments, and we'll just review, have we gotten answers to all these? So number one, founding morality on our instincts makes morality arbitrary. If we were to have different instincts, then different things would be pronounced good. I think we've spent a lot of time here saying why that's not the case for either of these guys. Are you ultimately satisfied with Hume's and Smith's answers to this objection? It sounded like, Wes, you were not.
No, I think it remains a problem. Again, if you want moral facts that are not relative in any sense, then yeah, this creates a problem. You have to get very sophisticated. You have to go to Kant and all that stuff.
You don't buy Smith's, like, the Percyan solution, that it is based on moral sentiments and that's how we know it, but ultimately that you sort of project toward a transcendent.
Well, yeah, that's one solution.
That's the ultimate moral fact. It's unknowable.
If you took out the God part, right? I mean, Smith's solution is God.
It has to be.
But epistemologically, it's not. It's all within, whether you call it just the moral sense or reason, he just doesn't care. Seemingly, he's not interested in the epistemological issue. But however it is, we can figure out in a variety of ways through our own experience that these are the laws set before us for us to follow. It's overdetermined in its correctness. You don't have to refer to God to say that this is the right thing.
The epistemological question is different than the ontological. How we figure it out and our capacity for figuring it out is different than our satisfaction with the grounding of moral truths. And I think Smith is appealing to God to ground moral truths because he wants it to be non-arbitrary. That sense of arbitrariness, it comes from saying, okay, this is the way human beings are constituted. How do you, for instance, deal with sociopaths or with supposed human beings have been constituted as sociopaths? Once you start taking a look at those hypotheticals, it becomes very difficult.
Right. I should say, just historically, Smith is acting in bringing up God here is just right in the tradition of most of the people in this British moralist anthology. That Samuel Clarke that you're talking about is just all about the reason that these things have these fitnesses and things is just because God made them that way. And that's just part of the teleology is God sets it up this way. So if Hume is not talking that way, then he's following Hobbes and sort of being the more radical naturalist about this.
I think that's right. This is a couple of routes to go. I think Wes, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like you're really interested in what would be called normative questions. So where are the norms coming from? How are they grounded? And how do they obligate? And the one way to do it is to appeal to God. Yeah. And it seems like Smith, with his system, he has to do that. Whereas someone like Hume is going to get out of the normative question by just looking at descriptions and looking at how we just do things. He's going to deny that there's some sort of gap between the is and the ought, and that the sort of normative force is just coming from the sort of norms themselves that we set up, and they're only grounded on the sort of utility of the social practice. So it seems like if you want to buy into Smith's system, and if you're worried about the normative question, you're going to have to appeal to God. Otherwise, there's no way.
Yeah, I think with any constructivist position, you're always going to deal with those arguments that it collapses into relativism, right? Like, you know, we talked on the blog about neopragmatists like Rorty get attacked as relativists. And it's not a settled debate as to whether you can make constructivism, even of the Kantian kind, or let's say a neopragmatist kind, work. I'd like to see it work. I just don't have enough knowledge of it to settle my uneasiness about it.
That was the hardest of the five questions. Number two, if morality were based on a moral instinct or sense, and an individual didn't have that, he'd be incapable of acting morally. But that's not the case. With reason and reflection, people can still determine, for instance, that gratitude is a fitting response to benevolence. It is a conceptual truth, or more precisely, a truth about the way things fit together, not about our concepts of them. Not a verdict of any sentiment. In other words, if morality were based on just a moral instinct or sense, and people didn't have that, we'd be just incapable of acting morally. But Ball Guy at least claims we don't have to have these. You could just figure out. You could just look at the relationships between, say, gratitude and beneficence and just see right there that gratitude is a fitting response to beneficence. You don't need a sentiment to tell you that. You just see it.
No.
I mean, do you find any force in that, or you just think this is just old crap?
Well, Khan will return.
There's no weight behind that statement because it begs the question. Without the moral sentiment, then there's no such thing as beneficence or gratitude or any of those things. And so that just doesn't make any sense to me as a criticism.
Well, that's why I kept retreating to calling him conceptual, because it almost like once you define a concept of beneficence and gratitude, then you can see these things.
Well, how do you respond to the example of a sociopath? Intuitively, we don't hold someone who's completely lost their mind and their reason to any moral standards. But we hold the sociopath to moral standards, despite the fact that they're so constituted as not to have any moral sentiment.
They're just going to bite the bullet on that. They don't care. Hume says in the introduction to the second inquiry, essentially, the fact that morality exists, morality qua, based on the sentiments, is not a question. And anyone that doesn't get this is just not really our concern. I think modern sentimentalists actually use sociopaths as an example to show how morality is based on the sentiments, because you can have these people that can actually explicate all of these kind of conceptual relations between, like, okay, you do this in this situation because you're related to this person in this way and so on, but they'll still not act on that, even though they understand the sort of reasons why you would want to do that. So that's the kind of argument against, it's like they don't get morality. And for someone like Hume and Smith, if they don't get morality, they're not part of the moral community. And if they're not part of the moral community, we're really not all that concerned. It might be unattractive, but I think that's kind of the way that they go about that.
Let's hit number three as close to this. Moral sense theory would allow virtue in brutes, right? Animals. This is a quote from Ball Guy. They pursue the instincts and impulses of nature more steadily and regularly than men. They show affection toward their offspring, and if a perception or a consciousness of the reasonableness of actions be not required to constitute the actions virtuous, what is there wanting to render many of theirs truly such? And it just seems Hume just says, we just have a different feeling when we behold the action of an animal and an action of a human. I don't know that that's really the case. I feel like a dog, one you know particularly well, can just seem like, wow, that was very spiteful. That dog is pissed at you. And if you have that kind of motivation, why not attribute some kind of virtue to it? Certainly we punish, not to the...
I think to the extent that, you know, animals have social awareness, I think the argument is that insofar as they lack self-consciousness, animals can't be capable of the same types of moral sentiments. But we know that's sort of on a continuum. And so a dog, for instance, is a very socially conscious animal, and you can observe dogs. I mean, usually it's right. Dogs that have been mistreated will behave in ways that seem like they have poor character. Let's say, you know, you have dogs that bite for. Yeah.
I am not taking that dog out. Wes, you can come, but your dog has got to stay.
Yeah. So for instance, I went to see a fair in Maine where they had a lot of sheepdogs. They were putting on a demonstration of how well sheepdogs could work together to herd sheep. And there was one dog which had been abused when he was younger. He was like a rescue dog. And while he was working, he was perfectly well behaved, perfectly cooperative with the other dogs. But once he was, you know, given the cue that he could relax and sort of be himself sort of thing, he habitually would bite at the ankles of other dogs. Like, not something that occurred when he was working, but something that he couldn't help himself. So that's sort of an example, something where you'd see, here's a vice in an animal in the way that you might see one in a human being. That's an example. And I found it very interesting that the dog could turn it off under certain conditions, but then was subject to it when he wasn't working.
Yeah.
Well, and if you're okay with that, then that sort of follows that line that we were talking about, Hume not distinguishing properly between the moral virtues and other kinds of virtues, that if you just want to say, in our experience, You know, a good-natured fellow is a good-natured fellow, and we don't even really care that much as far as our sentiments are concerned. How much is that as a result of just their moral choices and what we would call strictly moral, and how much is just, well, they're treated well as a kid and have a native cheerful disposition or something like that. So much of what we value that triggers our moral approval is not something that Kant would consider moral at all.
And just to, if I could add a funny anecdote about Hume and dogs. So none of the, so Hume hung out a lot in Paris, and none of the philosophers in Paris liked Rousseau, but Hume actually respected Rousseau quite a bit. He liked his second discourse. So Hume started to like, you know, he's like going to bring Rousseau around, even though none of the other people like him. And the problem was, is every time Hume would try to bring Rousseau around, is Rousseau would bring his dog with him, who was this like big, smelly, dirty dog. And Rousseau would always try to bring it to these parties. And so it ended up being the case that Hume had to give up trying to bring him around because Rousseau was always trying to bring his dog along.
And then ironically, Rousseau developed this like clinical paranoia towards Hume.
Yeah.
Thought Hume was out to get him when Hume was really one of his few defenders.
Thought he was part of a universal like conspiracy against him.
If only society back then, if only the philosophers of his day had Marmaduke comics to spread the understanding in Beethoven movies that big dogs are okay.
Yep.
And Rousseau's life would have been different.
Hume was really popular in France too, right?
He wrote treatise in France.
Yeah. And this was a time when people read this stuff. Yeah. And then the other thing I read was that he had a thick, thick Scottish accent and never really did anything about it. And I read someone, I forget who, it was like some anecdote from someone at the time who said something like, he's really the rage here. Like, he is fashion itself, but his French is just as indecipherable as his English.
So Ball Guy's number four is the one I already said, which is, if you think morality is a matter of sentiment, then it should be the stronger sentiment, should indicate the stronger virtue or something. Is that even worth responding to, or is that just, it seems these guys are so careful to state why that's not the case. No, it's cooler sentiments. That's what's I guess I don't see the force of this objection at all.
Yeah, whether they're cool or hot or whatever works at the end of the day is another thing, but they definitely try to like distinguish, definitely.
It is a challenge to conceptually clarify that if you really are going to say that virtue is equivalent to the sentiment, mm-hmm. not equivalent to reflections we have upon the sentiment. Because, right, Ball Guy is, and one of his other objections that is not, I'm not even including it among the five, is just that if you say it's all based on animal sentiments, that kind of just debases morality. It makes it sound crummy, whereas reason is all ennobling. Mm. Like, it's like an aesthetic objection. Yes. So I guess I put the same thing in here, that no, you have to have a conception of sentiment, as Hume and Smith do, that is more complex than just being struck with an animal passion. It's these second order passions, these second order desires, the interaction between them, competent judges, going back to our utilitarian episode, etc. Mm-hmm. All right, so then here's the last one, which I don't know that we've addressed fully, but it's a big one. Moral sentiment theory confuses exciting reasons for an action, which instincts can be, and justifying reasons for an action. No instinct could justify an action. So this would be Kant's exact response to this whole thing. Have we given a sufficient account of what Hume and Smith should say to this?
Smith can point to God.
Well, God harmonizes the passions with what's justified.
Right. He distinguishes between the efficient cause of our actions, which are these passions, and the final cause, right? In other words, the purpose for them. So it's like, it's good that they help out society, but that's not why we do them. It's not like we're thinking about society when we do this thing. It's because we're motivated by all these more immediate things. This is the same issue that we've already stated for Hume. That Hume doesn't have a good way of getting to justifying. It's just that there's no other criterion within our epistemological reach that could justify something besides just this is the way we already feel about it and the way we feel about it when we think about it hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he has no way to deal with that issue, mainly because he doesn't really see it as an issue. I think he's in a sort of long line of people that are just doing the sort of taxonomy bit, or like justification as descriptions of the things that we already do, which you can see in someone like Wittgenstein, or I think most successfully in someone like Hegel.
Yeah, I was going to say Nietzsche.
Nietzsche too, same, yeah, definitely.
Same ball game. That was sort of the revolutionary thing that came out of Nietzsche, but here it is right here.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's the way Nietzsche was taught to me, that get over trying to justify things against this pre-existence moral system that's stapled into nature, that once you get rid of references to God, you really have to think in a completely different way. And Nietzsche roundly condemned all the English for not getting that idea, that maybe somebody like Hume or Hobbes, who's not referring to God, but they still end up with an ethics that recommends all the same crap, that says that we approve of beneficence and things, and that Nietzsche thinks if we really pay attention to our sentiments on these things, we get startlingly different things. We get the will to power. We get approval of all this aggression that you don't get in
Hume. Well, yeah. The Nietzschean critique is that the English are reducing things to pain and pleasure, and he wants to talk about will to power. But I think will to power is intimately tied to...
You just reminded me of that Nietzsche quote about the English that I can't remember.
Oh, that. Yeah, yeah.
Men don't wish for pleasure, only the English.
Yes. Yeah, it's like the English are trying to universalize their sort of hobbit values, comfort and...
Again, I thought of that as with Smith and Hill, his talk of propriety, yeah. Just up the wazoo.
But it's, I think will to power, though, is intimately, so even though Hume is talking about pleasure and pain, all of this talk of sympathy and empathy and the recognition of others is intimately tied to the concept of will to power. So Hume is hinting at the very thing that Nietzsche will take as primary. The idea is that, and this is Hegel too, there's a certain type of pleasure, if you want to call it pleasure, but it's not like the simple sensory pleasures. It's the critical role of the recognition of others. Hume says we take pleasure in that. I think maybe Nietzsche thinks that pleasure is the wrong word there, but it's somehow more fundamental.
I do think that needs to be taken seriously, the kind of system of norms approach and the way that these certain sort of natural sentiments play into a sort of larger coherent structure of how we experience things and how we are supposed to act towards one another. And I do think that that's a sort of very powerful way of looking at ethics. And I think that contemporary moral philosophy doesn't take that approach enough, the kind of more robustly social approach to these kinds of issues.
Yeah. Just the fact that the foundation of morality is not, here's me isolated making this decision, which seems to be sort of what you do in intro ethics classes. And I was pleased to see that at least with this impartial spectator, it seemed like Smith gave us some tools to still deal with that. Whereas Hume, you know, and just sort of just considering this in the abstract, I didn't feel like Hume gave us much to deal with that. Like he sort of just doesn't take ethics seriously enough to want to bother with the, you know, how do we deal with abortion and capital punishment and the sort of things that come in ethics
classes. I think that's right. And he says when talking, because Locke's really concerned about, okay, how are we justifying obligating ourselves to the sovereign? Hume's whole line is, well, you obligate yourself to the sovereign and you get used to it.
I agree with Getty on this one, that I think there's something very fundamental about this view of how morality works. And it's not so much a question of grounding or systematic approach to morality, but the fundamental insight that our experience in the social context, our feelings are somehow integral to how morality works is important. And I very much like the, I want to use the term pragmatic, but that's not really the right word. There's a very, I guess, Scottish, I was going to say English, but it's only because they wrote in English, but it's really a Scottish way of approaching the question that I find very, I want to say down to earth. And I think it skirts the line between normative and descriptive. And I think all of the issues that Wes pointed out about this kind of social relativism, I'll call it, not relativism because it's not relativistic, but the fact that if society were different, the social norms would be different, which means because the developmental aspect, which Getty mentioned, which we didn't really talk about, but that morality is really developmental because you'll be inculcated to the moral norms of your society. And if your society is different, your moral norms will be different. That doesn't pose as much of a problem for me as it might for other people, but I still find the approach very satisfying. And I continue to be amazed. It's shocking to think that these guys were peers who knew each other. And there are other doctors and scientists and just this phenomenal explosion of intellectual activity in this very, very tiny, rainy corner of the world during this very brief window of time that's left such a lasting impact. Both of these two, Smith and economics, Hume and philosophy, being two of the towering figures in our tradition, is really just phenomenal. And it's a bit humbling.
Excellent. Next time, We will be reading Plato's Euthyphro, featuring special guest Matt Evans, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Michigan. Please look on partiallyexaminedlife.com to see lots of cool follow-up discussions, maybe a post or two from Getty, maybe. Maybe a post or two from Wes or Seth. Who knows? Miracles happen. follow us on Twitter. Join our Facebook group. Send your episodes to friends and family. If you're buying anything off Amazon for any reason, for God's sake, start your Amazon experience by going to one of our banner ads or book ads from one of our posts. Because if you do that, then anything you buy will give us a cut. So it's almost like giving us a donation without having to actually donate anything. Of course, we accept those too. And thank you, Getty. This was very great having you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for the experience.
And good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Your cup of water.